This podcast is supported by ARC, Antenatal Results and Choices. ARC is the only UK nationwide charity offering non-directive, individualised information and support to parents who are making decisions around antenatal screening and diagnostic testing. They also provide specialised bereavement care for those who experience termination for medical reasons. For more information or support, please call ARC on 0207 713 7486.
Hello and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR. Thank you for joining us for this very special podcast recording. This is our very first podcast with you, our live and in the flesh audience. We couldn't have brought this episode to you without the support of Antenatal Results and Choices, or ARC as we know them as, and so we're so thankful for them for helping us put this together. For this very special episode, we've pulled together a fantastic panel of experts, and they're here to answer all your termination for medical reasons questions. So let's get cracking. So let me introduce you to them. We have Dr. Brenda Kelly. She is a consultant obstetrician and a maternal and fetal medicine specialist at the Oxford University Hospitals Trust. In the past, she has developed an NIPT screening to help it make it safer for mothers and babies. We have Sally Kelly, a specialist midwife in bereavement care at a large teaching hospital in London. She has been supporting women and their families through TFMR for many years and is a strong advocate for their needs. And lastly, but certainly not least, we have Jane Fisher, director for ARC. Jane has been supporting women and healthcare professionals for over 20 years. There are probably a few of you here that have spoken with Jane or another ARC member of staff when you've got your own devastating news that something is seriously wrong with your baby. And no one can prepare you for that kind of news, and ARC does a fantastic job of supporting women through this minefield. So welcome to them and thank you. So I thought to kick us off, we might go to a audience member for her question.
Oh, hello. My name's Jess and my daughter Lyra was born on the 28th of February. I had a third trimester TFMR, and I'll just say a little bit about my circumstances to contextualise the question. So I was part of a research study that was offering completely incidental growth scans during my pregnancy, and it was at a 28-week scan at the hospital that they told me that they'd identified some ventricular megaly, and then from there I was under investigation by the fetal medicine unit. I was referred for an MRI, and the diagnosis that we got was quite significant partial agenesis of the corpus callosum, which they suggested was probably causing then the ventricular megaly. My question is really, given the late stage at which that was identified and the advice we got at the time, which is that you probably wouldn't have seen this at a 20-week anomaly scan. It's not necessarily a standard thing that's measured or looked at. And certainly partial agenesis is diagnosed through an MRI and not through an ultrasound. Does the panel feel like there's any further development that needs to take place in antenatal scanning for women later in pregnancy after 20 weeks? And should there be a greater place for MRIs in offering scans for reassurance for investigations for mothers?
So I'm going to turn to Brenda first.
I'm sorry you had that very sad experience with Jess. Sorry, Lyra, I beg your pardon. And the difficulty with central nervous system disorders is that they are quite challenging to pick up on the 20-week scan. And the fetal anomaly screening program in the UK is screening for very specific conditions which may be picked up with the 20-week scan, but it's not foolproof. It's a screen, so sometimes we can not see things that are perhaps there. Sometimes we cannot see things because they don't develop at that point. They develop later in pregnancy. The question about whether we should offer MRIs, or let's start with, should we offer ultrasound scan for everyone later in pregnancy? It might have the effect of offering false reassurance that everything's fine, when actually ultrasound isn't, you know, 100% diagnostic tool. It still remains a screening tool. Should we offer MRI scans at 28 weeks, 30 weeks to all women as part of that screening for later development of central nervous system disorders. And that's a trickier question to answer, because what we're looking at then is potentially a resource issue, and we're a public funded system. And it's not an insubstantial cost that then has to come at the expense of something else in the system for a pickup rate which may not be that high. The other concern I would have with that, Jess, is that inevitably, if we were to screen an unselected population of pregnant women, we will pick up things on the scan, MRI scan, because it's so detailed, but we may not be able to understand what that means. And my concern as a clinician would be that we don't understand the natural history. What does that mean for that baby moving forward? And you'll understand this, because when you had that diagnosis of partial agenesis, it's not a black and white, this is what you can absolutely expect as this baby is born, grows up, because it's not predictable and there's a spectrum. And so my concern, in addition to that resource issue, would be that we still may not pick up everything, and therefore we have to manage the expectation. We may pick up things that we don't know how to counsel about, because it may be part of the natural wonder of human beings that this is just something we see. It's incidental, it's of no significance, but the impact on any such finding would be huge for any parent expecting a baby.
Yeah, I mean, I agree almost wholeheartedly with that, in that, one, we don't have enough sonographers to do conventional 20-week scans at the moment, or earlier scans. We're really pushed resource-wise with sonography. And at ARC, we've certainly come across more later cases of people being given difficult news because they've been brought in for perhaps a growth scan or part of a research project, perhaps because the placenta is low-lying at 20 weeks. They're brought back and the probe goes on and the sonographer sees something that they're not comfortable with, which leads to more testing. And if you scale that up to offering it to every pregnant woman, you do run that risk of having a high proportion of people that are given news of huge uncertainty at a time in pregnancy when we couldn't promise that they would have options, because you're beyond 24 weeks, and we know that the law change at 24 weeks means that doctors are quite, there's more restriction on choice, put it that way. And that, I think, would be very, very difficult to manage.
I agree. Yeah, so it's trying to define. And it really is more the central nervous system disorders that are more problematic, in that so think of conditions like listen carefully, smooth brain, or some of the colossal disorders. And to fulfil what we call Clause E in our law, you'd have to be certain that there's a substantial risk of significant handicap, and that's not always possible. But it's that uncertainty, that diagnostic uncertainty, and that uncertainty about what it means for that particular baby in the future, it's very challenging. So it's not to say it won't ever happen in the future, but it's just to say it's really challenging.
And I think even at the moment, there's been this increase in scans for good reason, to try and prevent stillbirth, to try and look after small babies better, etc. But we have seen this upturn in diagnosis, and I don't think that has really been thought about carefully in relation to the support care women and couples get at that stage of pregnancy, because I don't have to tell you, it's awful whenever it happens, but when you get to that stage of pregnancy, when you've been through your 20-week scan, when you really think we're on the last lap here, we've prepared everything, everyone's ready for this new addition to the family, to get that news at that stage and have to go through ending the pregnancy at that stage is so harrowing and difficult, and there's not always the support in place that could be. And we'd need to have much more of that if we were going to have more detection.
Sally, is there anything that you'd like to add to that? Or?
No, I mean, we don't see it happening that often. But when we do, and when it's a situation after you've had your 20-week scan, I think that the impact on the parents, it seems to multiply hugely, because it wasn't expected. You know, I've had to sit with a family, you know, the father said, but clearly you guys missed something. And we actually got the scans out and we said, look, here's the 20-week scan and this brain is absolutely fine from what we can see. And I think that's an area that we do need to look at, is actually better education with families as they go through that screening is never going to be diagnostic. And I think that's really important to know, because if you go to the 20-week scan with the thought that I came away and they said my baby was okay, it's okay as far as we can see. But that doesn't mean to say that there is nothing, you know, potentially that could happen after that.
Yeah.
And that's the difficulty.
It's hard, though, isn't it? Because the special place of ultrasound is screening and diagnosis. It's a screening tool when they can't be sure. But for something like anencephaly or spina bifida, that's the tool that will lead to the diagnosis. And it looks so good, the equipment now, the images you get set up this expectation that, you know, I can see my baby, I can see it so clearly, surely they'd be able to pick up if there's something going on. So it's quite difficult to manage that expectation.
Yeah, but I think it's also, you're right, this has come back to the information that parents have access to at the time of the anomaly scan. So I'm going to go back to the brain development, because it's unlike, for example, cardiac development. So at 20 weeks, all the bits of the heart are there. And yes, occasionally you get some problems with how the valves work later in pregnancy, but that's unusual. But with the brain, it's such a dynamic structure. There's so much happening, particularly in that third trimester, that, you know, everything can look completely normal at 20 weeks. So it's not that something was missed. I think we need to sort of ensure that when people are opting for anomaly scan at 20 weeks, that there is that understanding that there's still so much development happening. Yeah, I'm not saying that to sort of say, look, it's okay that we missed it for you, but it's one of the challenges of screening.
I sort of feel like this is sort of part and parcel with how society views pregnancy and babies, really, that we sort of, there's an assumption for many of us when we, especially that very first pregnancy, that, you know, it's going to be okay for me. And we don't hear the stories, we don't have the reality that it isn't always that case.
I guess it would be very difficult to sit everybody down. Obviously, yeah. People in this audience have had this horrendous and difficult experience, and you can't probably get across to people that haven't been through it just how awful it is. So they can't know. And I suppose we've often said this because it often comes up in the training we do, in the policy work we do. You know, it's all about educating women and couples much better before they have screening. If they knew more about the screening, it would be okay. It will never be okay.
Yeah.
However good the pretest information, you're never going to prepare someone psychologically for that moment.
Yeah.
That
nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. I mean, what I'm hearing you say is even if you tell people, these are all the things that could happen.
And
to make it
a white knuckle ride for everybody.
Yeah.
But it's also come back for many parents that have met and scanned over the years. That anomaly scan, yes, on one level it's, yes, we want to look at the structures, but actually for most parents it's an opportunity to meet their baby.
Yeah.
They haven't seen those babies since 12 weeks, and it's actually such a, you know, delight to sort of watch movements and things. So hence the curveball that has hit many people here is all the more devastating.
Yeah. Yeah. Jess, do you want to?
Yeah, thank you for those considered responses. I just suppose, listening to that and thinking about it, I wonder, as a follow-up, is there any advice you would give to parents who have potentially been through this process and then conceive again about ways that they could advocate for themselves to make sure that they're getting information, particularly about corpus callosum disorders, during the process of another pregnancy, so that they don't feel like they're on tenterhooks quite so much, or will have that dialogue where they're feeling understood by the clinicians they're then being looked after about, you know, why they might seek additional scans or might want to have investigations either earlier or additionally.
And that's something that comes up time and again. I can remember being at the parents' conference a few years ago with ARC, and that same conversation came up around how hard it is to advocate for your own needs when you're pregnant again, because actually being pregnant after a TFMR is so triggering in so many ways, with the trauma of loss, and scans just add to that, because scan is when things went wrong last time. So on one hand, you've got this traumatic loss, and yet you want to advocate for the thing that you know is going to trigger anxiety, but it's hugely important because parents need that level of reassurance. And, you know, my advice always is, you know, that I know what we do in our own practice where I am in Oxford, and I know there's going to be variation across the UK and the world and wherever people are listening from. But it's, please just ask the questions, particularly in something like a CNS disorder, which isn't necessarily going to pick up 20 weeks. So heaven forbid people should reassure you at 20 weeks, because you're not going to get reassured at 20 weeks. Mm. What you need is a scan at 28 weeks. And, you know, with the evolution of neurosonography, so in our department we have a couple of specialists who specialise in the neuroanatomy using an ultrasound scan, and we compare where we are with our pickup rate here with scanning and MRI, and actually it's equivalent. So I would strongly recommend, if you're a parent in future pregnancy after such a loss, that it's okay to ask. And in fact, you shouldn't have to ask, if I'm being honest. But again, sometimes it comes down to resource constraints. So unfortunately, some parents have met and said, well, we were told it's a 1% chance of recurrence, and therefore, you know, it's unlikely to happen, therefore we can't access the scan. I don't think that's fair, because if you happen to be that person who's had it before, that statistic is pretty meaningless, given how rare that condition is in the population.
I can absolutely attest to that experience, because we've already been told it by Cambridge University Hospitals.
Yeah, and I think we hear that sometimes, that some clinicians actually think they're being helpful and reassuring by saying, no, we're not going to give you any extra testing. You don't need it, because this time it's going to be okay. There's very little chance of it recurring, thinking they're doing the parents a service, and of course it's not helpful.
But also this resource issue, I've got a moral difficulty with that, because an MRI scan costs, you know, £450-£500, okay? But what is the cost of the psychological distress and the use of services and other way and extra midwife appointments?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's going to equate to, you know, ameliorate your distress, but the cost to parents when we don't support them, when they don't feel heard or seen, and they feel that we're imposing on them something that just doesn't sit right with them.
Yeah, I mean, because it's not a physiological or physical need, but a psychological need. It's not taken as seriously, which is
I think that is dependent also on who you've got to access. So for instance, the families that I work with, when we have our follow-up appointment after, you know, the initial time that the baby has died, where we're going through maybe post-mortems or any sort of like tests and things like that, the results of those, and making a plan for the future. Within that plan, we also incorporate the fact that there will be extra support from the bereavement team, so that alongside your normal antenatal care, you can have extra care. Now, that's not going to happen in every single place, and that's the problem. And I know that within the bereavement midwives, there's quite a few of us around the country now, but what we're trying to do is really get the service to meet the needs of the families, because we know that the long-term implication for these families can be dire because they haven't had the mental health input. So I'm very lucky that our hospital is part of the pilot scheme for trauma and loss. So people who have had traumatic experiences that might not have ended up with their baby dying, but also those where their baby has died or they've had to make decisions about their baby and ending a pregnancy, where they can actually be referred at that first stage. And I have had a huge weight lifted off of my shoulders in having that service now available, because I can say to somebody, if I'm not there, because actually in most cases you'll find your bereavement midwives are singular in each trust, and as a team, that's quite difficult to do 24/7. So to have this other input from a mental health point of view, where you can speak to a counsellor and or psychologist and or psychiatrist if necessary, because you are going to meet up with, you know, there's always going to be something that you suddenly, it will trigger you. You know, something will be said, you'll see something, you'll hear something. Maybe you go into the same room you were scanned in. So the sort of thing that you're going to do is have a discussion with your bereavement midwife or whoever and say, it was room 5. Can you make sure that I don't go into room 5?
Yes.
Thank you. My name's Emma, and I just wanted to pick up on something that Sally said about the long-term impact of TFMR. My TFMR was, 13 years ago now. And,
It's okay, Emma.
We had such a bad experience. We didn't have support. And that's one of the reasons why I've come along today, because I wanted to see that things had changed. And I wanted to feel heartened that parents aren't going through the same trauma that we went through all that time ago. It's only in the last sort of 6 months that I've actually started admitting what happened to us, because we were made to feel such shame and guilt and didn't get the support we needed. So I think that it's imperative, Sally, what you're saying about giving parents the support that they need now, when it's happening to them now, because the long-term impact has affected our family for so long. And I just think that that's one of the most imperative, important things for the mental health of all involved.
Absolutely. I mean, I just find that it has a huge impact on the family at any stage. But if it isn't dealt with, if you don't support that family at that point, then it can only get progressively worse. And so I think you'll find that the majority of bereavement midwives in the country are aiming that we're going to have gold standards that actually put you guys totally central to what we do. Because there's a lot of other things that we have to do, which we're actually saying, do you know what? Let's park those. Let's have someone else doing those bits. Because we need to actually focus on the families and find out what they need. And I think that's really crucial. And we're all a bit of a weird group of people. Okay, but we're all pretty passionate about what we do. And I think that changes are afoot. Changes are already happening. And that's only going to grow the stronger that our organisation of mad women is. Yeah. Because, you know, we all have this very definite vision of what it should be like. It'd be better if it wasn't happening, but it is happening. So let's look at the elephant in the room and let's actually say, how can we make this just a little bit easier? And it is, it's just thinking that one step ahead. So I have a young woman, and when she went in for her scan, I went with her and her partner. And we actually said to the sonographer, please don't be silent. I know that you're looking for a thing, but what I want you to do first of all is first look that we've got a heartbeat or that we haven't got this particular condition as much as you can, because, of course, it's a very difficult process doing a scan, and people have to concentrate very much on what they're doing. But you know, you don't want to wait 10 minutes to find out whether there's actually a heartbeat, because that's kind of like now I need to know everything's okay.
Can I just also come back, and Emma, I'm really, really sorry that your experience of care was so poor and that hasn't helped your recovery from what happened. And you mentioned being made to feel shame and guilt.
Yeah.
And that comes up so frequently when we're discussing TFMR. And it's something, obviously, we do everything to counter. But it's also the fact that sometimes, because of the conflicted feelings women couples have about what's happened, about the decision they make, it's that they don't access help because they feel undeserving of it. I'm not saying that was your case, but following on from what Sally was saying, it's beholden on professionals to actually make the offer, make sure that people are aware that they're absolutely deserving, of course they are, of bereavement support, of ongoing care, of signposting to ARC, whatever it might be that would be helpful.
I was just going to say, and also even if they're not ready then, because there may be the sort of not right now, or no, you know, it may even just be, I don't think I will ever want to do this, but for them to know that that's okay. And if that changes, you can come back. That this is not a closed door. If you say no now, we're here.
But it's going to, not every trust is blessed to have bereavement midwives with the passion of Sally. And I have worked with some fantastic bereavement midwives over the years. We have the National Bereavement Care Pathway, and I was really heartened to see that there is actually a TFMR guidance within that bundle of different pathways. So this is all baby loss. I think the thing I was disappointed about was, and I don't know, Sally, how you feel about this, but it wasn't specific to TFMR as much as I would like it to have been. It felt a little bit generic, that it's great we're recognising this as baby loss. Let's reduce some of that stigma and shame that you felt from 13 years ago. So things have changed, Emma, in that way, that there is recognition now. This is bereavement in the same way that miscarriage, ectopic stillbirth is bereavement. But I think the pathway could have gone further to bring in some of what you've alluded to, which is there's a stigma, there's a shame, there's a guilt, it's complex. And some of the points that Jane's made, you know, we need to sort of say this is loss, but it's not just like any other loss, because this is a loss that parts of society still don't accept. So I think to come back to what your ask was, have things changed? I think things are evolving and have evolved from 13 years ago, but we've still got work to do. And the second point I was going to make is that a lot of the bereavement care, a lot of training goes into, you know, helping doctors, midwives, nurses work with parents as they go through the loss. My interest is actually, how can we support those parents, like Jess, in that next pregnancy? Because that's where there's so much activation, reactivation of the trauma, of the loss, of the guilt, of the shame. And unfortunately, that reactivates, not just in the first pregnancy after the loss, but in subsequent pregnancies, when there's an assumption that, oh, well, actually, that was 3 pregnancies ago, it's fine. I had a patient, a mum on Monday, that was due to scan because of an issue in pregnancy. And I was going through her records and I could see that her first child was a TFMR. She was 17 years old. And her second child was healthy and fine. The name of the second child was in the notes. The name of the first child wasn't. This is like a late TFMR. And I was like, you know, she was 17 when that happened, you know. And so one of the first things I said in that conversation was, I'm sorry, but I don't know your son's name. And it instantly was this, you know, dam busting experience in the consultation. It's like, okay, we can sit with this. Because this is really, really important that we acknowledge that Freddie is part of your life. He might as well be here in this room as a 7-year-old, because he's that important in this unit of care that we're going to offer. But I'm mindful of that because I've listened to so many parents over the years. What I would love to see is greater training, not just of increasing bereavement specialist midwives, because they don't quite often get that involved in second, third, subsequent pregnancies. But I think every health professional involved in maternity care, whether it's a GP, doctor, midwife, should be cognizant of the fact that there's a lot of trauma that comes out in subsequent pregnancies and a lot of renewal of grief. And that bond that you have with your baby that you lost is still there and needs to be acknowledged. And that's what's missing. So if I was to say, my ask would be, can we please look to this and look to how we help health professionals navigate that in a way that can be part of the healing process? It's not going to ever take away the loss, but it can form a really important part of that healing process.
And I think also, I mean, we've also got something like quite a few trusts now are beginning to integrate rainbow clinics. So this is babies born after loss, so subsequent pregnancies. And again, the idea behind that is to nurture through that time so that you have a single point of contact. But also it means that the staff who are working there also know that when, so for instance, I have little cards with a rainbow on it. If that's on your notes, all the staff are meant to know that this baby is following at some point. Because somebody said to me, well, is it just the previous one? And I went, no, if anyone's experienced a pregnancy loss, it doesn't just stop because they've gone on to have another baby that didn't die. It means that they still need support because this isn't going away any day now.
I'm going to be a little bit, I'm just going to be a little bit controversial, Sally, actually, as is my wont sometimes.
Now it's getting good.
it's brilliant that the clinic like that set up and really important to have those run it absolutely here. All that Brenda said too, it's so crucial. It's something we touch on in our training with health professionals, that it's so important to look after people well in those subsequent pregnancies, have really good coordinated care. I sometimes struggle with rainbow. And I struggle with rainbow not because I do, but because of hearing from women who talk about, well, what is this rainbow? Okay, if it's a rainbow, then that means there's been some storm beforehand. And I don't want to conceptualize my baby as a bad thing, as a storm. I want that memory to sit with me in a different way. So I'm not saying we shouldn't use the term rainbow clinic, but it's been interesting to me the women who have said, I struggle with that because it's not...
I'm conflicted for a different reason. because, and this is just because of some work I've done with parents locally who've experienced various types of baby loss, about parenting and pregnancy after that loss. And I think it should be a universal thing. Okay, let me preface by saying, I think it's great you have a specialist continuity of care pathway, call it the Rainbow Clinic or whatever you want to call it, because continuity of care is absolutely crucial. Unfortunately, my experience of services is that getting the resource is challenging. So it's not, it's quite often it's the first pregnancy after loss, because given the extent of loss, I don't think locally we can look after women through subsequent pregnancies, you know, beyond the first pregnancy after loss. So my problem then is if you silo that expertise into one clinic, so you've got this amazing obstetrician, amazing group of midwives, and you've got sonographers who you can know you can tap on to scan that woman because you know the sonographers are fantastic in their demeanour. That's brilliant. But actually, I really want the level, because you've experienced this, and I want the level across the decks to improve in terms of that quality.
And that was the idea behind the National Breathing Care Pathway, is actually that it is multidisciplinary, so that even if your porter pushes you in the wheelchair after having had a procedure, they need to be aware that potentially you may have had a loss, and that they are careful with how they talk and how they treat people. And I think, you know, the receptionist, I mean, we have to be honest here. We have met a few receptionists who are a little bit snappy. Okay, and when you're going up to that desk, that's where my little rainbow cards, and my butterfly cards as well, because what I don't want them to have to do, I don't want you to have to come into that maternity unit and go up to that desk, and when that receptionist goes, and what are you here for?
We've had that where people have said, I can't hear you, speak a bit louder, what are you here for? And there's a whole clinic.
And I've had somebody else who said, you know, well, are you even pregnant? And, you know, I want to kind of like just disappear in a hole in the ground. So by having those things and trying to prepare people all around you, there needs to be some sort of symbol that says to anyone, actually, a lot has gone on before this person came in here. And we need to have some understanding and some compassion. We don't need to know all the details. We just need to know that they need extra special care.
Emma, how is that sounding for you? Is there anything you'd like to...
No, it's promising that there are things in the pipeline that are going to make, God forbid, that, you know, many more women have to go through this. I'm sure they will, unfortunately, but that their experience will be better than the experience that I had. Just going back to what Sally said about even things like the same room. So when we lost Grace, she didn't have any kidneys, and therefore I had no amniotic fluid, and her lungs didn't develop, and I was a third trimester TFMR as well. But then my second child, my son, came along and everything was fine, but we were offered automatically scans at 16 weeks, 20 weeks, 24, 28 weeks, which was great. But with my third daughter, Annabelle, she actually only has one kidney, and it was the same sonographer in the same room when I went for the scans with her, giving the same, oh, I think there's a problem with the kidneys here. So I think that that is definitely something that staff need to be aware of, because, as you say, it just triggers that trauma again and just brings it all back. So just the little things that people, I mean, why would you think about that? Unless you're specifically told these women have been through this and this is something that could happen. It is specific training that needs to take place.
But in the world, there are a lot of things that have happened to people we know nothing about.
No.
So actually, should we not just assume that possibly people have had something happen to them? And why can't we just
treat people with compassion
people with
and
compassion,
empathy?
Right, for the word go. Yeah. How joyous that would be.
Yes.
It's just a quick point on that, though, too. It's interesting that, it's all about asking parents what is right for them. Because, I'm thinking of another couple who actually wanted to go back to the same room, to the same sonographer, because they felt that sonographer had handled it really well and wanted to go back and have a different experience sharing it with that person. So it's all about what's right.
And in terms of trauma therapy, actually, that can be an important part of trauma therapy.
Yeah. The sort of close a loop.
The re-experiencing in a very, it can diffuse the trauma in a way that
Agree. I mean, it's about the choice of the family.
Yeah.
and what is right for that person, because what's right for one person isn't necessarily the right thing for another person, but it's being able to hear them.
Yeah, this comes back to that consultation. It's professionals have to create the space for parents to say, actually, this is what really would make a difference, mm-hmm. with the understanding that no amount of scans is ever going to give you the complete reassurance. But actually, if at that particular time that scan would help, then I think there's an obligation to do that.
Yeah, thank you. We've got another.
Yeah, hi, I'm Vicky. I just wanted to go back to what Sally was saying about kind of aftercare in terms of trauma and mental health and kind of well-being and looking after parents when they've been through this process and the roles of different people. And I was kind of reflecting on where the perinatal mental health services come into this, because my own experience was, my perception, rightly or wrongly, was that when I needed help from them, I felt that I was declined because I didn't have a baby, and that therefore I didn't have a baby to attach to. And so it kind of like wasn't their remit, and I was kind of like shuffled off to a different service, even though in my mind I was like, I've just been pregnant, I've just delivered a baby, I'm you know, postpartum, I'm going for all the issues that you normally would deal with apart from my baby is dead. And I wondered if that's something that you see or often, or if services are becoming more joined up, or if that's, I don't know.
That's where this trauma and loss for us in this pilot group has taken over that thing, because that was something that has been raised many times. It's almost like if you have perinatal mental health, all is fine and dandy if you're referred, you know, in the pregnancy and up to a year post-delivery, unless your baby doesn't come out of that. And I was saying, but I don't get it. Would you not think that this person is far more likely potentially to need a lot more mental health support? They've got an awful lot more to deal with. And so when I was told that this pilot was coming, I was just, it was such a relief for me. And I know that my families will be seen within 2 weeks. That's a long time anyway, but it's actually much better than what's out there at the moment, which is no one wants you really to contact them for at least 3 months. But I also couldn't understand why mental health couldn't see that the two things, it's the same if the baby has gone, or you've got
it
just makes no sense to me whatsoever.
But do you think, Sally, I know that locally our perinatal mental health teams are oversubscribed, under-resourced, okay? Mm. So I wonder whether sometimes there's the assumption. So what I'm going to say here is I think baby loss is baby loss, whether it's TFMR or whether it's stillbirth or with the added extra complexity around TFMR and the trauma. But I wonder whether sometimes the commissioning of those services is partly that, well, actually, you guys who've been bereaved have your own charities and support elsewhere. You've got Cruise, you've got Petals, you've got Tommy's, you've got ARC, and you can go somewhere else. So it's almost like, it's not that you're not important, but we think there's resources somewhere else, not really recognising that those other resources are also backed up as well.
Yeah.
So you're right to highlight it.
Yeah, but I think for me, I became quite mentally unwell. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was only because my bereavement midwives were very good and made sure that I had onward referral. But, you know, there's always like a block. And there's only so much charities and your bereavement midwives can do in their constraints in terms of, you know, when someone is deteriorating. And it's very difficult.
I mean, if you hit with perinatal mental health, if you're acutely unwell, you've hit a threshold, baby present or no baby present.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really sorry you had that experience.
Yeah, and we come across it time and time again with people trying to access proper psychological support services. Obviously, we do what we can, but there are those people that will benefit from therapeutic services, from counselling, etc. And it's almost impossible to access.
But the other challenge some that you, Vicky, would face is that having to tell the story again.
Yeah.
You know, when you're trying to advocate for yourself, you're exhausted.
Yeah.
And to then have to tell a new person.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, come back to Emerson, that sort of shame and the stigma. And if it's the right decision for you to go through what you've gone through, it's devastating. But you're then always mindful of the judgments at the end of the phone and whether that impacts on the triaging of your referral and so forth. Mm. So it's just that we use that word mind-field.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, the Ockerden report that's just come out, the second one, I actually think is potentially going to make a difference for everybody in this group, because I kind of feel that money will be put into being able to support people better, because clearly parents have spoken up about, and okay, so not all of them had TMFR, some of them have gone through different things, but it doesn't matter. There's still the grief there. There's still the much wanted baby that once had to make a choice. I hate that word. I hate it. No, it isn't. It's a rock and a hard place for a family to come to those sort of conclusions, to feel that that's the only way forward for them or otherwise. Whatever they choose, they need to be supported. But they need to be supported not just in the physical sense, but also in the mental sense.
So thank you, Vicky. That was a really good question. Thank you. And we've got another question.
I'm Alice. And I was just thinking about those two different things. But yeah, the first was like raising the level of awareness across the board, but from literally every level. And I don't want to expect too much of everyone, obviously, but even the people delivering food, literally walking in the middle of labour, asking what we want to eat and giving us supper. It was very bizarre. It was almost funny. Like, it was so bizarre.
We've heard this before. But it was... You're not the only one who has had people walk in offering food in the middle of labour.
Very odd. Yeah. But in a way, it was amusing, so I don't know whether, but it was still quite hard. And my mom was sort of fielding them at the door. And then to my GP, who, to be honest, I didn't have the best experience of, sort of, the receptionist asked me if I'm going to take my baby to my 6-week checkup, and I completely lost it. And the other thing was, so that I got phone calls from midwives for checkups and then ringing them back, and then it was all baby related stuff, so that was quite stressful. I also understand not wanting to be separate from that. It's this difficult balance. But the other thing I was going to ask was to do with counselling, because you brought it up and it overlaps with some of what you've said, but it took maybe a month or two to start counselling, which was great that they have it. I'm very grateful it's there and free. But it did take a bit of time, and I was almost told that it's good to have time before you start the counselling, and I found that really hard because the first month I was completely... I just didn't know how to talk to anyone. I didn't know who to talk to. I felt completely isolated, and kind of that's when I really felt I needed to talk to a counsellor.
It's a good point, and yeah. I think that obviously I don't know whether you had details of us at that time, because it's something really...
I was a bit scared in the interim time,
dealing with people who are in really acute distress in the early days after their experience. And I think what the conventional thinking is that, yes, you could see a counsellor just to cry and howl your pain, but to actually start to explore the feelings and something around the experience that particularly has affected you, it's too early. You can't do that. You're too raw. So to go somewhere to cry, absolutely fine. And I think, too, it's tempting because to sit with those feelings is so scary and overwhelming that you want someone to take them away. And no counsellor, no therapist, however skilled, is actually going to be able to take them away. They can be with you, as we are, can do. We can be with you in the very most difficult, distressing moments. But they have to be lived through in a way which is really, really hard.
So I'm a trainee therapist. So I sort of feel I'm quite conflicted with hearing that. And I think as a mother who's been through termination and other forms of baby loss as well, the logical, as Jane is saying, you know, I can see that argument. And on the other hand, there's a very human part here that you just need just a safe space to come.
Yeah. To be held.
But someone who can stand.
And
to be
I think,
with you
so this is what I was going to say. I think that is the moments. Difficulty, is finding somebody who can take it.
Mm. Mm.
And I'm not sure how many people would be able to take it in that raw state.
Doesn't mean we shouldn't have that space. But it's just, yeah.
And but you, again, I think what we come across from feedback is that it's a very unregulated area. Mm-hmm. You've got counsellors that really can't hack it. And that's always our fear that people who are very vulnerable are in the hands of people who are just outside their expertise.
Yeah.
And not only that, they're not familiar, as you say, it is their expertise, but there's death and then there's death and there's loss and there's loss and there's grieving and there's grieving. Mm. And it's knowing that you're able to, you know, have contact with somebody who understands the grief process that you're going through, the pain that you're going through. Because if that's not there, then they kind of miss the point. And if they miss the point, you will close off from them.
It's about the safety, is basically what it is, is feeling really, really safe. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ria, and my TFMR was 6 years ago. I just wanted to talk about my experience of the counselling that I was offered following termination. So the bereavement midwives were excellent. I was offered the counselling. I was given a session. It was probably about a month after, and my appointment was given to me at the antenatal clinic where I'd been going for my scans all along. So I turned up at the antenatal clinic with all these pregnant women around me turning up to have their 12 and 20-week scans. I sat in the waiting room with the women, and I had to start all over again. It was almost like, well, what are you here for? My first question was, are your counselling sessions always here? And the response I got was, yes, is that a problem? So, yeah, I just wanted to give my experience of how different the care can be. For me, it was the counselling, it wasn't really counselling, it was more kind of tick box. So it was just a number of questions that I was being asked. And like I said, it was going back to the beginning, having to tell my whole story rather than them already being aware of why I was there. I didn't go back after that session, to be honest, and I got private counselling that helped me, which was a shame.
I've got two thoughts. That one, did you feel at all empowered to say, actually, I don't think I can come back here to an area? Did you feel that you could have that conversation, or was it simply, they're going to be and that's it?
I did feedback to the bereavement midwives because they were still in touch with me at that point, and they said that they would feedback and take it further, but I made that decision that I didn't want it. It wasn't, that first session wasn't helpful for me. I didn't want to put myself through that again, so I made that decision not to.
I mean, it is a challenge. I'm not a psychologist, and Hayley is training to be one, so but I'm just thinking of that sort of telling for me when I meet with parents in subsequent pregnancies. It's so important to create that space in the consultation early in pregnancy to say, actually, this is a safe space. Because to me, the talking about what happened before, the telling and the retelling is part of a way of building the narrative. And yes, it involves revisiting the trauma and the loss, but actually it's another way of maintaining that bond with your baby and trying to make sense of it in a way. And I do I work in a clinic for women and girls with gender mutilation. So we have a psychologist in clinic, and quite often the one who will access that psychology service, I have to explain, first of all, before I refer them, that the first appointment is assessment. Because I think it's really important that they understand that it's not going to be launching straight into therapy. There will be some questionnaires to establish where a baseline is, you know, what level of trauma, what level of flashbacks triggering, you know, where are we at? Because we then need to sort of work out how we can get you to a different place. Yeah. And I don't know what the questionnaires were or anything, but sometimes that retelling, sometimes that assessment, at least if we set it up properly with parents to say, this is what you should expect of those early appointments, because every therapist has to make some form of assessment at the start. But it's about laying out that table.
It's about being very open and honest about that and letting people know what to expect. And it doesn't sound like you really got that at all. It sounded like it was quite a blank wall.
Yeah, and it's like you said, it's setting it up. Yeah. So there was no kind of introduction. It was like, right, here are some questions. Yeah. Let's get on with it.
Without any context.
And it sounded like it was a lack of human connection. Yeah. I mean, this is what...
Compassion.
Compassion.
And I felt like that just came down to training of who was providing me with that counselling.
Yeah.
I don't know what their background was, but it didn't feel like they'd had the correct training to deal with what I was there for.
Yeah, and to not feel that you're with somebody who has that competence is really difficult when you're feeling so vulnerable. To think you're with somebody who doesn't really know how they're handling it is hard, I think, because you've got to click with them and feel trust, haven't you?
And Lillian sort of talking about telling and retelling the story has been an important part of that recovery process. It's telling and retelling to one person.
Yeah.
It's not having to do it to different people every time. The receptionist is like, yeah, and that's comes back to that resource and that continuity.
Mm. And they will need, any counsellor or therapist will, imagine, need to hear the telling from the person that it happened to, because you can have notes on somebody, you can have a description of their experience, but it's what it meant to you, Ria. What, tell me about what happened in your own words and how it was for you.
That's what I didn't get.
I think also, I mean, for instance, one of the things that I recommend to people is to give a brief summary of what they've gone through, so that whenever they go to a clinic or anything, I suggest that they offer that to the person and say, please read this before you ask me any questions. Because if they've got a starting point to go from, because sometimes people, you know, they might not be aware of your story, but you need to get that out straight away. So if they're given a piece of paper with that on there, then your assumption should be that actually they now know a little bit, and now we can proceed. We can open up a little bit more, because those first words are the hardest.
Sally, I'm going to come back to what Emma was asking about, how have we changed in 13 years? Because I'm just thinking, we're conducting this conversation in English, and we're conducting it at quite a high level. And I'm just thinking of some of the families that I've worked with in the past, and they aren't speaking English as a first language. And yet their experience of loss is as deep and traumatic and lasting as anyone in this room. So can I ask the question then of you, as Next for Improvement Care Pathways, how are we moving towards equity in that regard?
To be honest, I think that we're nowhere near equitable. But I think that, again, we're now looking at the fact that we want information to be available for people in different languages. And that we also emphasise very much that within the process, that if somebody doesn't have English as their first language, that there should always be a translator and not a family member. But also that the translator is initially au fait enough that they can deal with that. Because they're very, you know, there's one thing, I speak fluent German, but I'm not going to speak fluent German about, I don't know, like a brewery or something. I have no comprehension of all the things that go on in a brewery. So you want to make sure that whoever is translating has that ability and has that knowledge for themselves to be able to explain something as difficult as the findings of a scan or anything like that. And they need to be able to deliver it in such a way that the family can make a safe
informed decision.
Yeah.
I'm just also thinking about, as I say, for me, part of it's the after, and it's the subsequent pregnancies, and it's been able to provide equitable care in that regard. And, you know, I do think psychological therapies as a whole, we struggle with having enough suitably qualified therapists who have an interest expertise in this area to be able to work positively with parents. But then, you know, I just feel that there are parents who are denied that level of care by virtue of where they come from, their language. Yeah. And actually, some of those parents are coming from cultures where we talk about the stigma in this room and the shame. But I've worked with parents who come from cultures where, you know, there would be serious consequences if it was found that they had a TFMR. So I just, my hope, Emma, coming back to where I'd love to see the next 10 years going, would be that we've brought the pitch up to a certain way that it's better than what it was when you were experiencing your loss. We're not quite there, but I'd like to see the next 10 years being a bit more inclusive.
Yeah.
And it's hard, I think, also for the voluntary sector, an organisation like ARC, to work in that space as well. We recognise that we are going to translate some of our materials, but we're also mindful of to translate a booklet about TFMR with nothing behind it is really tough, because where do people go with their questions? Where do they go with their ongoing support? So we're doing some thinking. And it's hard because some cultural groups, ethnic groups, will not think of coming to an external organisation either. It will be something they would always go to family members or people around them, and how to just make sure that those women and couples have what they need is really challenging.
We need to get to wine and cheese straws. And for everyone who's listening to this episode now, after we've recorded, you've missed the wine and cheese straws. Next time we do a live recording, you're going to have to get in on some of that action. But I just wanted to say thank you to our panel, but mostly, thank you so much to our audience members. You are amazing, because you've made this the episode that it is. So I would like to give a big round of applause to our audience. Thank you.